Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, February 22nd, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, I think I'm sitting probably right now, depending on when you're listening to this, but I would bet I'm just sitting in my apartment saying, Saul, please, let's just go outside, buddy. Come on, put some clothes on. Let's go outside. This is the 50th fort we've built. Ah, dude, please. What do you mean you're going out tomorrow? That's his new thing now. He says, is it the weekend? I'm like, yeah, it's the weekend. And he goes, okay, today I'm staying in. Tomorrow I'll go out.
I relate a lot to that.
Do you feel, yeah? He strikes me as a guy who may end up being a little bookish, if you get my drift. I mean, he's athletic, but I don't know. He's a bit of a homebody. He doesn't like to get out of his, basically just likes to run around the house in his underwear all day. We'll see. But yes, it is one of our vacation shows. That's my point, I think. That's why I told you that whole story. We are not on this week. However, we do have all new content for you, our dear listener, and some deep archive stuff. One of those special Matt's picks for the fun half. Today on the first half of the program, author Shane Burley on fascism today. What is it and how to end it? And I have to say that, you know, sometimes we will book guests and haven't read too far into a book or something. We'll do it, you know, we'll book them far out in advance. And we've had a couple of authors on over the past couple of months on topics similar to this. And I have to say that, like, I don't know what it was, and you'll listen, you'll judge, but I feel like the way that Burley lays this out is as clear and concise and nuanced, I feel like, of an interview that we've had on this topic. And so definitely worth your listening. And also, it's interesting, it plays into the question of platforming and others. And it gives a taxonomy of where people are on the spectrum. So I imagine you're going to enjoy this quite a bit. We will have one more new show for you tomorrow. That is a Friday. And then we will be back live on Monday of next week. I don't know what the date is. And I imagine I'll be rip-roaring to get away from my kids. All right, folks. Quick break. When we come back, Shane Burley. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report. On the phone, it's a pleasure to welcome Shane Burley. He is a Portland-based writer and author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. Shane, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Forgive me, this is a pretty rudimentary question, first question, particularly of an author who has written Fascism Today, What It Is. What is fascism?
Well, so the definition I go for in the book is kind of along two axes. On the one hand, fascism is about identity, a really centralized version of identity. It's basically an identity that you can't shake off. It's something that goes deep inside you. So basically, different axes that people identify themselves with, race, gender, and so on, the fascist right really say are defining in really fixed ways. Race obviously being the most obvious of them, thinking that race is significant and real, not a social construct, both biologically and spiritually, gender, sexual orientation, and so on. The other axis on that is inequality, the belief that human beings are not equal. And that differences have to be kind of ranked vertically rather than horizontally. And a society is best and most healthy when stratified. Those things together kind of also brought in line with a kind of mythological sense about that identity, a sense of immediacy and violence, and a really connection between their elitism on the one hand and populism, their kind of popular appeal on the other. That's what really helps build a fascist movement.
Okay, so let me, I want to make sure that people are able to digest that. So these two elements that are essential, the belief that race is real, as opposed to a social construct. So what does that mean? I mean, I think people understand the idea that race is a social construct, but is it that when you say race is real, that race is destiny?
Yeah, exactly. One of the prime things that the fascist right has done for most of the second half of the 20th century and into the 21st century is focused on a pseudoscience about racial differences. The primary one being intelligence, IQ, racial difference in IQ. These are arguments that we had 100 years ago, 200 years ago, that the brain size of different people from different areas of the world were capable. These are things that have just been...
I'm sorry, Shane. We just lost you for a second. Shane, we just lost you for a second. That brain sizes of different of people around the world were...
So that was a pseudoscience that was believed by a lot of racist sectors for years and years and has been decidedly disproven by modern science. Yet it's not a point that the fascist right or the alt-right would ever take. So one thing that they'll focus on is this idea that there is racial differences in IQ, that white people are decidedly smarter than folks arriving from Africa or Latin American people. That's one of those kind of prime racial differences, the essentialized racial quality that they like to focus on. Another one is temperament, this belief that different races have different personalities that are innate to their genetics. Again, something that has absolutely no scientific basis. And then they try and build a kind of mythology along that, focusing on a lot of stereotypes about people of color and then trying to argue that those are actually scientifically founded, such as criminality or sexual behaviors. That's part of when I say they believe in a centralizing narrative about identity. It's that race actually drives people's personalities, backgrounds, traditions, cultures, and so on.
And then that second element you talk about is that there are... that people are both different and unequal, as opposed to just different, I guess. And you say
right.
That they measure these differences on a vertical rather than horizontal spectrum. And so the idea being that, I mean, well, tell us a little bit about that vertical spectrum. Like, what is, in their worldview, what is that built on, right? I mean, because we could structure a sort of a merit-based, if you will, or we could structure a vertical measure of people's worth in any way we want, I guess, theoretically, right? I mean, mine would be how many hours a day you do a podcast. That's really the pinnacle, and then so on. But what in their world, what is that that vertical? What are the attributes that one uses to determine that vertical hierarchy?
Yeah. So part of it, on the one hand, is that they want to see things in stratified ways. Because really one of the things at the core of that is this belief that we need elite tastes of people to control others, and that their kind of mythological image of traditional empire with rulers on top and serfs on the bottom is actually the healthy way that humans organize themselves. They'll look at a lot of things and try and argue that they are superior, inferior, and most of these qualities are things that we would say are relative or non-essential for our modern understanding of them. So obviously intelligence is one of them. They believe that, on the one hand, intelligence is biologically driven, and therefore there are smart people and there are stupid people, and the smart people should have superior access over the stupid people. They'll talk about this with body types. There are, you know, ideal body types and unideal body types. Then they'll go into things that really are sociological. They'll talk about criminality and, you know, virtuous citizenship. Or they'll talk about, mental health and mental illness. And, of course, they wrap in all kinds of different things into mental illness, such as, homosexuality or other types of ways of living that they don't agree with. And so a lot of it ends up being really up to interpretation. Their interpretation uses a very antiquated system of values and then tries to rank them. And it's not surprising that most of the times the people doing the ranking in this rank themselves pretty high, and the rest of people, not just people not in their racial group, but people, not just people outside of the racial group, but also people inside, will be ranked lower. It's always important inside fascist movements to see themselves as superior in some way, which is what helps determine their outsider nature.
How do they negotiate that with themselves? I mean, for instance, like if I was to set up my hierarchy, right, expand it to races of people, right? Like in my hierarchy, like I say, like the superior race is the one that has, a propensity to be able to do podcasts every day or 4 days a week, let's say. So for me, I can just, I can just look and say like, okay, it just so happens I do 4 days a week of podcasting, and therefore I am, part of the sort of the master race. I look at some of these people who are, of this ilk, and maybe, I don't know, you see videos of them and whatnot. I mean, how do they look in the mirror and actually say, based upon their system of ranking superiority, that they're actually on top?
I think it's important to note that in all of these white nationalist circles, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance that's happening. I mean, it takes a lot of that to start off with to make arguments about race and IQ when 99% of science would discredit what you're saying, right? It takes a lot of gall to make these antiquated 19th century arguments about race and crime without any science to back it up. And it especially does that when people look at their own life situations and then create a narrative where actually they're biologically and spiritually superior to other people. So I think on the one hand, there's a lot to do in building these communities about, lying to oneself and also creating a narrative about why they're not doing well. Part of it is that they see the modern world as taking care of or supporting people who are lower on their totem pole, and then going ahead and arguing that the reason they're not doing well is because of this system that supports people that don't deserve it. And so that kind of narrative, that excuse, that blaming is really, really important for building that. And I think it also creates that false narrative where they see themselves as really people against time, people who are working against the forces of modernity that has destroyed the white race.
So that, that's how aggrievement travels through the various shades of being on the right. I mean, that aggrievement in one fashion or another does a lot of work. It's the fundamental reason why they need to organize, right? Because they are superior, yet they are being subjugated in some fashion, or because society has rewarded lesser types.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of that narrative is they believe that if the world was ordered the way it, quote unquote, should be, then they would be on top, naturally. I mean, why wouldn't they be? They are part of that superior case. They just described it. And so if it wasn't for, Jewish control of the media and the banks and the government, if it wasn't for widespread degeneracy, if it wasn't for the influence of Marxism, if it wasn't for all of these different forces, then their rightful place of superiority would be maintained. And I think the other part of it is that it's really easy to kind of make fun of some of the folks that on the lower socioeconomic spectrum that are involved in these movements, but they really do see themselves as part of kind of a warriorhood, part of an everyday man against the forces that are invading. And so there's an easy way of transposing themselves into an air of real importance. I mean, in their daily lives, they might not be very important, but in this, if you reframe into all of history as the battle of the white race against people who would destroy it, and that they're taking up that charge and becoming kind of an everyday soldier, well, that becomes very important. And in a world where people are very atomized and where people's jobs maybe don't feel significant, I see that there's a lot of attraction to that.
Well, contrast, I guess, your definition of fascism from one that where there's a conventional wisdom. I mean, I don't know that it's dramatically different, but it is. There's certainly an important nuanced difference. Contrast that for us.
It depends on what you mean by the conventional narrative. In a lot of ways, this narrative is tied into what in some academic circles is called the new consensus about an ideological core to fascism, that fascist movements in different times in different countries kind of have a similar pattern of thought, around lines of the idea of a need for national rebirth, the creation of a mythological understanding of the past, use of romanticism, and so on. So it's in line with that in some ways. One thing I think that makes it a little bit different is that a lot of people, when they talk about fascism, one, they focus on interwar Europe, basically Italy, Germany, Austria, and so on, and what those movements looked like, and specifically how those parties worked, how authoritarian they were, and what came later. And then on the other hand, they focus on the process by which a country becomes fascist. And what we're talking about here is not a process by which a country becomes fascist. We're talking about a small minority movement that holds fascist ideas. They haven't come to power yet, hopefully never, but they definitely don't hold power today in any kind of mass way. And so what we're describing is the kind of thought process and ideologies that they have, not the process by which a nation becomes that. That's something different. And so I think the conversation, though, has been for a very long time about how politics goes in that direction. And what that does is ignores that there's actually fascist ideologues in our midst right now trying to influence things before it's actually gotten going.
Let's talk about Richard Spencer in this way, because you have... I mean, I guess you came to this topic through Spencer in some ways, yes?
In a weird way, yes. When I was first, go backwards a number of years, there was an appearance. I was living in upstate New York, teaching at a college there, and there was an appearance happening of David Irving. He's a well-known Holocaust denier, probably the best-known Holocaust denier. And we were kind of like researching groups that might be coming out to one of his events and trying to get a better sense of what was going on. And I came across this podcast with a guy named Richard Spencer. This was back in early 2011. And there was something about the way that he spoke and the way that he explained things that I thought, this guy could have traction if the circumstances became right. And so I kind of started watching it then and started writing about it in 2015 when it really started to launch out. And he had created, in a lot of ways, his own brand of it, which was at the time around a website called AlternativeRight.com. It's no longer around, but the phrase stayed. Alternative Right was shortened to Alt-Right, and it's about what we have today. And basically what he was doing was he was taking all these intellectual currents that were sort of dissidents from the conventional GOP and trying to link them up. And they're all really focused on race, and mostly focused on white nationalism. And so that's what he was able to kind of bring forward into a movement. And so a lot of people who maybe were being attracted to that, but were, maybe not interested in the KKK or neo-Nazi style of things, could go into the style presented by Richard Spencer and by a number of institutions, American Renaissance and other quote-unquote race realist institutions. But basically they had a more upscale middle-class look to them. that was able, he was able to kind of recruit with that, and was able to take the same ideas of white nationalism, just tweak the language a bit, make it seem a little bit more collegiate, and then and re-deliver it. And that's really what he was able to do. By the time 2015 happened, a lot of kind of trollsters and you know, podcasters and things kind of jumped on the alt-right bandwagon, and they were able to really launch it.
And I should say, I mean, just to make it clear, he, because he was at that time only doing one podcast a week, very low on my hierarchy of superiority, of super
races. Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah, he definitely would have been a leader there, right?
I mean, well, so, all right, so, I mean, track that for us. I mean, I guess, I mean, I want to place him. And, you know, we've done this a couple of times over the past couple of months, maybe over the past year, you know, created these sort of like taxonomies of of the right. And I'd like you to take a stab at it, because just to get a sense of like, we know the alt-right was at least the moniker was developed by Spencer. What elements was he bringing in? So he's basically doing this show and going down the line and like clanging the bells of different types of folks on the right. Give us a sense of who those people are.
Yeah, yeah. So he was doing a show called Vanguard Radio. It was through his website, alternativeright.com, and he created a podcast that followed that up. Called the Radix Journal podcast after he left Alternative Right, left it behind in 2014. So he essentially was trying to build an intellectual base. And so what he was doing was bringing along people that had ideas that were maybe divergent, but they built on that kind of that core we talked about, that the essential inequality and identity. And so he was bringing on figures like Jack Donovan, who writes about male tribalism and kind of an essential gendered nature. He was bringing on anti-immigrant kind of figures like Peter Brimelow from V-Dare. And he was bringing on people who talked about race and IQ. He was bringing on people who would talk about paganism. For him and a lot of white nationalists, they find something kind of spiritually essential about Nordic paganism, basically heathenry. And take a racial interpretation of it. He was bringing on different people that would come at it from these different intellectual angles. At the same time, he was also trying to revive different philosophers. So there was a thing called the European New Right. These were a series of academics starting in the late 60s, early 70s, that started writing a number of books that were essentially fascist philosophy, but very well coded. And they would use a lot of left-wing jargon. They were anti-capitalist. They were, quote-unquote, anti-imperialist. They were really for kind of racial nation states. And he would bring along people, he would start talking about conservative revolutionary authors. These were far right philosophers from the early part of the century, many in Germany. And so what he wanted to do is build this sense that this fascist right, it wasn't just about reactionary racism. No, it was like a whole philosophical system with science, history, geography, books and all kinds of things. It was international and it had a lot of value to it. And that's really how he was able to build that base. So when we come in 2015, we weren't just talking about people that were just talking about blogs. No, they had like a whole history and tradition they were trying to tap into at that point.
And so, that's fascinating to me. So that's basically his, you know, when he sat down with his producer, he's like, here are the elements I want to bring, and this is going to bring in differing constituencies across the board. We're going to have our anti-immigrant people who might not be as comfortable with our overt racism, but they're coming from anti-immigration from a slightly different place. I mean, is that sort of the calculation you imagine takes place?
I think anti-immigrant anger is a real prime way that the alt-right recruits today. It's one of the places where they have crossover with the GOP, frankly. Also, it's along Islamophobia.
Right.
And I think also along a feeling of discontent with the economy. I mean, one of the things that's really important to understand about the modern fascist movement is that in a lot of ways it's anti-capitalist. Not from the same precepts as the left, right? The left is anti-capitalist because they want greater equality. Obviously, the alt-right and the fascist right doesn't want that, but they do see the economy leaving behind quote unquote, the white working class. And so they oppose it along those lines. But I think, yeah, definitely being able to tap reactionary anger, whether it's towards immigrants, whether it's towards Muslims, whether it's towards feminists or LGBT people, and be able to give it a logic and say, nope, that's actually correct. You should feel that way. And here's why. We have a whole narrative that we can give you about why. It's not just about your impulse. It's that we can actually provide you a whole base for why you're feeling that way.
And that becomes one of their, I guess, one of their marketing slogans, right? We're just doing fact-based inquiry.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, they're just looking into race and IQ because they're really interested in science. Of course, they're just big science enthusiasts. Except the reality is they're just showing you the couple of marginal scientists with discredited research that can prove their weird racist points, right? And they do that with immigration and crime statistics. They do that science studies on gender differences. That they do that across the board.
Okay, I want to circle back to some of those other things, but before we do, you said that they're anti-capitalist, obviously not in the way that the left is. How does it manifest itself? I mean, is their anti-capitalism one that is rooted in the fact that, like, our capitalism has been corrupted because of the Jewish bankers, or is it our capitalism has been corrupted because we have weak leaders who insist upon, redistributing wealth to, black people? Is it a notion of, like, capitalism is inherently problematic because it is too egalitarian in some fashion? I mean, what is the critique? Like, where do we see that critique?
Oh, all of the above. So one of the things that is true in the European New Right, the alt-right really develops it. And there's a whole theory behind this called third positionism, right? They're against both capitalism and communism. They want a third way.
Feudalism.
Capitalism a lot. What's that?
Feudalism, right? On some level? I mean, is that...
I think for some of them. I think also the term National Socialism, and I don't just mean specifically the Nazi type, but I think that term actually makes a lot of sense when we're discussing this. You know, what they see is capitalism as an anarchic system of wealth accumulation that does deprioritizes the nation and sovereignty and traditional living as they see it, right? So a capitalist cares not who they're dealing with. They care for money. And so they might, not think about their racial brotherhood. They might not put, another white person first, right? It also doesn't value traditional religious life necessarily or the traditional family. I mean, this is all from their kind of characterization, right? At the same time, it also homogenizes cultures, right? Through international trade, you actually have cultural artifacts going across borders. And in a lot of ways, it breaks down regional identities, those kind of traditional nationalistic tribalist identities that they have. The other thing is that it brings people across borders and it shares those sorts of things and creates cross kind of racial alliances. A good example of this is the organized working class. If people are going to identify as a working class in a capitalist system, they have to identify across racial lines to organize like they do in unions. So all of that kind of bothers them. The other thing is that, like you said, in a way it's too equalizing, it's too egalitarian, because they want enforced inequality. Mussolini used the term class collaboration. It's the idea that there should be different classes, right? Some people have more, some people have less. They know their place and they maintain that system. And so what they would rather see is something controlled by elites in a nation's interests that distribute stuff, and are able to maintain a strict hierarchy in the economy. The other thing is that I think it should never be ignored is that a lot of this quote unquote elite that they talk about is a caricature of Jews. It's sometimes not coded anti-Semitism. They're pretty open about it, but sometimes in the more obscured language, they code it and they don't say Jewish people and they use some other kind of euphemism. So all of those things, I think, play into their sense of anti-capitalism.
And you write that one of their I don't know if you would call it a tactic or a strategy or just a sort of, you know, part of their ideology is to co-opt left positions. Is that in the context of populism? Is it in that context of being anti-capitalist in some fashion? I mean, how does that play out?
Yeah, it is. So one of the ways that they do this has been that obviously the anti-capitalism is one, and they'll focus on left critiques of capitalism, like look how it's destroying the working class, look how capitalism is destroying, subsistence farming or something along those lines. And then they'll also go with the environmental arguments as well. But then they really actually use a lot of language they found in the new left, and specifically what was called at the time third world liberation movements. I think we'd call them national liberation struggles or post-colonial struggles. Basically, in the late 60s, early 70s, there's a really rise of these movements, and a lot of the baby boomer generation that's going to be caught up in radical politics had a lot of solidarity with struggles of indigenous peoples against colonizing populations. And so what they tried to do was flip that language on its head a bit and say, you know what, we are actually in favor of all of these national liberation movements. We're in favor of any movement that reclaims its national identity and its sense of itself. And you know what, for white people too, we need to liberate white people from that homogenizing globalized capitalist force as well. And so it gave them a sort of kind of in. It was, they were manipulating that language. And they've done this with a lot. For example, being opposed to war, they're definitely opposed to interventionist wars. Why? Because they want American first policy. They don't want the U.S. being involved in other countries. And there's a lot of examples of this. And really across the board and left circles, they've tried to do that. They adopt environmental arguments. And actually, what they try and do is use environmental sentiment to argue for against population expansion, as they'll call it, immigration. Or they'll try and use caricatures about people in the global south as having higher birth rates or something. So they find in the left, in left-wing aims, something that they can use to manipulate for whatever their racist purposes are.
Okay, so talk about the sort of the outreach, if you will. I mean, you say that fascists need a bridge to the mainstream, I guess, presumably to sort of, welcome people into their movement. What makes that bridge in our society today?
Yeah, they've always needed a bridge, and this has historically happened in the U.S., a good example of it was called paleoconservatism in the 80s and early 90s. It was sort of a dissident strain in the GOP that was against the neoconservative trend towards foreign intervention.
Let me just note this, that at the Republican National Convention in 2004, I was on Radio Row. A guy comes up to me, and I think at that time they presumed that everybody on radio was to the right. And he saddled up to me and he said, he saw that I was from Air America, didn't quite know exactly where we were, but assumed we weren't on the right. And he goes, I'm not with any of these neocons. I'm with Pat Buchanan. These neocons, they're all Jews. So he wasn't quite up on exactly who he was talking to at the time. But I found that fascinating because I think that was the first time I sort of realized, like, there's a divide here. That is, only a sentence deep before you get to full-on anti-Semitism. And I presume, maybe I don't know what else they diverge from. But that was a term that got very popular in the early aughts, the paleoconservatives, to differentiate themselves from those neoconservatives who were specifically about importing democracy at the butt of a gun, or I guess.
Right. The globalists, they might call them today, right?
Right.
So Pat Buchanan was the best-known figure of that paleoconservative movement, who was essentially making, in a lot of ways, just coded white nationalist arguments, sometimes not even well-coded. Today, it works a little bit differently. A lot of movements of the past, the mainstreamers who are politicians or people involved in some way with the GOP, but today, that crossover sphere, in a lot of ways, is just internet movements and figures. There are people that help mainstream the alt-right's message, especially the talking points about immigration, Islam, and feminism, but they don't really commit to the white nationalist program ideologically, necessarily. And a lot of times we used civic nationalist talking points instead of racial nationalist ones.
These that's when we took, like Breitbart, right? I mean, that's like
right,
Breitbart.
Exactly. Breitbart would be these figures. Milo Yiannopoulos, Lauren Southern, and Rebel Media. Ann Coulter, in a lot of ways, has stepped up to that. Mike Cernovich and some conspiracy-laden people. All of those together make up what I call in the book the alt-light, which is sort of the diet alt-right. It's the figures that help mainstream those ideas without really committing to white nationalism.
Is that Gavin McInnes, those guys?
Absolutely, absolutely. Gavin's a really good example of that. Peter Brimelow, now at VDR, a lot of these figures have helped to take these talking points and move them into the stratosphere, even if they're not, if under investigation, they're not going to commit to the anti-Semitic racist program. They definitely are helping mainstream those racist messages.
And then is there an alt-light light? Because, I mean, I'm thinking of guys like Dave Rubin and like Sam Harris, who, you know, buy into very, you know, maybe Rubin, it's increasingly wider, but narrower elements of that broader program. And sort of, one, is there an alt-light light in your mind that is, you know, they may not be, let's say, the centerpiece of that bridge, but they provide maybe the last 6 or 8 feet or something to get across that ravine. And what is, I mean, I imagine maybe I already know the answer to this, but how do you imagine, is it simply like when a Milo Yiannopoulos says, like, I will be able to provide this and that, is it an ideological program? Is it that there's other motivations like celebrity and I'm willing to do this and that for that, but I'm not going to do a full frontal? I mean, what goes into the creation of the bridge?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think with the last 8 feet of that bridge, like you're talking about, there's a lot of people who make that up. Some of it's just made up by Trumpism in general, right? Like, these are Trumpist figures who are more tied to the GOP. A lot of times those actually are GOP figures. They're saying a lot of these things. But frankly, I think a lot of people who are slipping into the alt-right role in general. You mentioned Sam Harris. Well, he goes on programs talking about race and IQ stuff. I don't know about you, but to me, that's over the line. And I think it's okay and safe to start saying, yeah, there is a line here and you've crossed it. I think with people like, you know, it's hard to say with some of these alt-right figures. Take Mike Cernovich, for example. He seems to make a very good living doing this. He seems to really like soaking up the celebrity and the fame. So I think in a lot of ways that's a really prime mover in it. I think that was certainly true of Milo, and it's true of Ann Coulter. I don't think that's all of it, though. They could do that in a lot of ways. I think that there is a certain true believerism in it, but I don't know if – I know it's hard to say how far it goes. I think with Milo, as we see with a lot of those Breitbart revelations, that his ideas went a lot deeper than people thought. That's definitely true of Steve Bannon. With someone like Mike Cernovich or Alex Jones, I don't think that's so true. I think like it really is a lot more about celebrity and also kind of whatever weird ideas they've concocted in their head separate of the rest of the movement. So I think it ends up being a combination of both. But remember, these people are riding a wave, and from their career standpoint, it'd be stupid for them not to exploit this as far as they can. And with someone like Mike Cernovich, for example, he's not going to have a career on CNN or Fox News. So what does he have to lose? Is this really his only shot?
Right. All right. Well, let's get to, I mean, this is all very fascinating. But let's get to the how to end it part of your book. Can we end it? And when you say end it, what do you mean by end it? And then how do we?
What I talk about in the book is what I call kind of a mass movement of anti-fascism, mass anti-fascist movement. And really what this means is to bring organizing back to its basics. One, you need people. Two, you need organizations. And three, you need coordination, right? You need a lot of people working together on a lot of different fronts. It can't be one organization or one group of people at one time. And so in the book, I see basically a large survey of examples. I talk about organizing in rural areas, both NGO, nonprofit-style organizing, and grassroots kind of direct action organizing. I talk about militant anti-fascist organizing. I talk about like more liberal and coordinated approaches. I talk about organizing on campuses, organizing labor unions all across the board. And the reason is that all of those are necessary. And we're seeing where fascists are growing, where their organizing is targeting, and we need to be able to have approaches there. And it would be really presumptuous of me to say that X, Y, and Z strategy is going to work from a distance all the time. What we need is conscious organizers that understand how to do pressure campaigns, that understand how to coordinate people to be organizing in those sectors around those issues. And so I think the dominant thing that people need to look at is, what does it take for a fascist group to organize and grow? And those are the things that anti-fascists need to strategize and target, which means going after public events. It means going after the organizations that are recruiting, to stop them, to block them, and at the same time, to go after the issues they're talking about, and then to be able to confront those and to grow movements that are going to be tolerant of immigrants, that are going to support immigrants that are facing deportations or are facing racist harassment, to be able to support trans people who are under attack, to be able to support people being murdered in police violence and that kind of thing. So we really have to think about what it takes to mobilize large communities of people around issues in a long-term way.
So if I hear you correctly, you're saying on one end, deplatform them in some fashion or another. Deplatform them or mute their platform, or, you know, even if it's play a tuba so that people don't hear what they're saying, actually makes a difference. And then on the other hand, also see who the victims or the focus of their issue sets are, and go and defend those people or those institutions. All right. So if those are the two elements there, I mean, what about when fascism seems to be operating on some level on an institutional level, right, as opposed to, you know, Richard Spencer and his YouTube show or whatever it is, like ICE.
Yeah. Well, then I think it means resisting the institution, right? We're seeing a mass revolt against ICE deportation. Rapid response networks where people are showing up when people are being deported. They're helping to block those, civil disobedience, all kinds of ways. Focusing on sanctuary movement, sanctuary cities, sanctuary organizations, sanctuary churches, sanctuary unions, all kinds of places that provide sanctuaries and refuse to participate with ICE deportation. And what I think has shown, what shows results, is mass participation of refusal. So, like, for example, when Trump first announced his travel ban, we saw this mass show up at airports, right? This really large mass movement that helped turn the culture, but also showed that there would be a force of the people that wouldn't cooperate with this. And I think that is what shows the largest results when an institution is being taken over by the far right and is manifesting far right aims. It's to show that the people that are being governed in the state really aren't going to participate in that, and actually will stand against it in a really concerted and coordinated way.
Shane Burley, the book is Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. It's a really direct and well done piece of work in this area that I think it's having a clear sense of both what fascism is and how it spreads, and obviously then how to end it is, I think, increasingly important in our world today, sadly. But Shane, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.